Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. We're going to pick up where we left off in our immigration series that's airing all week on this program. And today's focus, well, it's on work visas, particularly the H-1B and O-1. And we'll explain how they work in just a bit. But right now, the visa system for skilled foreign workers is in the middle of a fierce political debate. Republicans, for instance, they claim the visas bring in workers that are willing to accept lower pay than Americans, and that some employers are taking advantage of that. Meanwhile, various industries like tech and finance, they actually rely on the foreign visa program because otherwise they say that they can't find enough qualified staff who are from here. And here's the other thing. Getting a visa for these very niche and specialty occupations is no cakewalk. You might assume that if you're really skilled in a certain field and there's a need, that you'll just be approved. But rather than an emphasis on skill, a dose of luck and where you come from can play a huge part. So when I told you on yesterday's pod that this is complicated, I wasn't kidding. This week, we're breaking down the immigration process for various visas and giving the vast majority of you a 101 of sorts. Our panel today will get you caught up on the latest with the ever-changing national policies. They'll explain what you may not know about the grueling work visa process, and we'll hear personal stories. At the table, we had Prashanth. That name is a pseudonym. And Christina Coleman, who's founding partner of Coleman Immigration. Now, given the increased fear these days, it's been a bit of a challenge to find people willing to share their personal stories on this topic. So in order to protect their identities, several of our guests this week will use pseudonyms or just their first name. Christina started off by breaking down the basics. I asked her, what are work visas and who are they for?
Non-immigrant visas are often, not everybody realizes that they are temporary visas, and that means they have an end date. And one of the ones that has been most popular in the news, certainly later, was actually created in 1990 by Congress. And there are only 85,000 of them available every year, and you have to have a minimum of a U.S. bachelor's degree or equivalent in a specialty field to be eligible for one.
And you're talking about the H?
Yes.
H-1B.
Yes.
Funny you say there that it's become popular in the news, because I remember a time when nobody was talking about H-1Bs, unless you were someone who was from a foreign country and going through the process and knew the ins and outs of it. This wasn't like wide kitchen table conversation. Was that your experience, Prashanth?
Yeah, I would say so. I filed for H-1B back in 2014. I mean, the conversation about H-1B was mostly among our friends who were also immigrants. Like, it wasn't so political like as it is now. There was no talk about it on Twitter or like any YouTube. Like, it was more like personal. The system was still like complicated back then, but it wasn't as much as like talked about.
Yeah. What changed, you think?
I think the polarization and also the COVID kind of caused the immigration to be more, there's like more backlog now. It was easier for me to find an appointment to get a stamping back then. But now I have to like, you know, wait like a couple of years, which makes I cannot go back home to, you know, see my family or like do some personal events that I have to do.
Yeah.
So a lot of things changed post-COVID.
Yeah, a lot of things were put on pause during those COVID years. And so imagine now joining the line again and waiting for the backlog of folks who have been sitting in and waiting as their files sort of collected dust. Christina, walk us through the difference between an H-1B, as we talked about, and an O-1, like I mentioned. What are the difference between those two work visas?
So two main differences. One is that you have to have a very specific degree level and type for the H-1B. It's very closely scrutinized by USCIS, and that is the Immigration Service. You may have heard of INS. Now that's USCIS.
Yes.
And they're the service arm, quote unquote, of the Immigration Service inside the United States. So when you file an H-1B petition, they are going to make sure that the degree you have is equivalent to a four-year bachelor's degree in a very specific field, and that that field relates closely to the job. And the second big requirement that I think a lot of people aren't aware of is there is a mandated wage, and it is mandated by the Department of Labor, who reviews the wages every year in July, and you have to pay a minimum of what they say is the wage for that particular job, and it's set by this complex standard occupational category where you choose the wage and you put in where the job is going to be, including the county, and they'll tell you what the minimum wage, not the federal minimum wage of $7.25.
Right. So is this better?
It's much higher.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and every year it's gone up dramatically in the last 5 years, as has everything else. But the wages are very competitive. I mean, they reflect what people are getting paid for that job in that area.
And the O-1 is also, it's also a specialty.
It is, but there's no degree requirement and there's no salary requirement. It can be an indicator that you're at the very top of your field if you're getting a very high wage compared to other people, but it's not a determining factor. The O-1 has a lot more flexibility, I would say, but you do have to show that you are pretty much at the top of your field, that you have extraordinary ability in a certain area, which is, and it's a wide area.
Right. And before we dig more into Prashant's story, I'm curious if, from your view, Christina, if you think that where you come from changes things. So which country you're coming from, does that sort of impact how far you'll get with the process of an H-1B or an O-1 or some of the rules and policies that we see laid out? Are there certain pockets of the country that maybe some of these options are not available to? What does it look like to you?
For an H-1B, I don't think it comes into play that much. Typically,
so are they accepting degrees from everywhere?
Oh, well, you do have to have an evaluation done by an accredited agency. So you can't just say, oh, I have a degree from Spain and I'm representing to you that it's equivalent. You have to have an equivalency done, and it has to be a four-year degree or an equivalent thereof. So yes, you do have to clear that hurdle before you will be accepted.
So Prashant, you're in the middle of this circus, if you will, right, where folks are talking about H-1Bs all day, but this was your real life, right? This has been your real life. Walk us through your personal story. Tell us from the beginning, what do you do?
So I work in wastewater treatment. I'm an environmental engineer.
Wastewater treatment. Okay. Sounds complicated.
Interesting too.
It's
poop treatment. But I came to US in 2011 for grad school. So I did my master's and graduated in 2013.
So you started on a student visa?
Yes, I did. And from student visa, I transitioned into work visa, but it didn't happen easily. So I started with a small employer who wasn't very much familiar with the immigration system. But the student visa allows you to work for, like, you know, 2 years on STEM extension, OPT.
Okay.
So using that, I was able to, like, convince my employer, like, you know, hey, like, I'm able to work without any kind of sponsorship. Then when I got the job, in those 2 years, I have to prove them, like, you know, for what's going to come in the future, which is H-1B. So I said, like, you know, hey, it's been 2 years now and my work visa, my extension is going to be, you know, expiring. I need a sponsorship visa.
How did your employer respond to that request?
I think, like, at this point, I think that's, like, you know, how you have the conversation. I didn't have this conversation right away. So I was with them proving, like, what I bring to the table for, like, 2 years. And they saw the value in me. And they were just open, like, you know, okay, what do you need to do? Like, they have no idea, like, you know, about the procedures. So,
of course, yeah. So you probably had to teach them.
Yeah, I did, actually. Even for STEM extension.
Been there.
Yeah. I made them e-verified. Then I had to, like, you know, we had to consult with an attorney. And, I mean, the procedure itself is, like, you know, it's not like you can randomly, like, apply. The company, the employer has to, like, post if they are hiring for H-1B. They have to post, like, the H-1B job posting along with the salary somewhere in the company where everyone could see.
Yeah. So they have to be transparent about what they're doing.
Yes, they have to be transparent, and there's like minimum prevailing wage that they need to follow. And so I got into H-1B program back in 2014, and so I've been, I'm still on H-1B like since then.
And your industry, as I understand it, it's not a common one for the H-1B.
Exactly. So it is still more kind of challenging to make people understand, because now, because how polarized it is, there's like stigma and there's a vagueness in the immigration in general. They think, the employers think it is more complicated. It's going to like cost money. And also like, you know, there's no uncertainty. So in that aspect, like most in my field, it's hard to get a job with sponsorship. Like most often you get auto rejection when you apply. If you say yes,
right,
you're going to be auto rejected because unlike citizenship or like other protected categories, you know, immigration doesn't come under those categories.
I see. I see. Christina, what, something that Prashant mentioned that I want some clarification on. He mentioned while he was on the student visa, being able to work, right? A specific program or training program that he was able to do afterwards. Many, many moons ago, as a Canadian, I was also on a student visa here in the U.S. doing some studies. And I remembered, I'm like, I don't remember if I could work at the time, but I do remember like working at my university, like in the computer lab, for instance. I feel like that was the only thing I was allowed to do back then. Have things sort of changed and opened up for student visa holders?
No, it's still the same. There's some on-campus employment permitted during the course of your degree, but generally you are authorized to work for 1 year upon graduation in a program that's called optional practical training.
Yeah.
And everybody gets a year, but then individuals who've graduated with a STEM degree, and those are defined, and actually they were broadened a couple of years ago, can get an extra 2 years. They've got to get a few concessions from the employer. They have to register and e-verify. They have to put in a training plan to show that the program really relates, but you can get up to 3 years. The issue is that if you wait the full 3 years to apply for an H-1B, you may not prevail in the lottery. Prashant, I think you are very lucky.
Prashant, that was a risk.
Yeah. So my my chance at lottery was just one. Like, you know, my last time when they applied, that was, if I missed it, I would have, you know, I would have gone back. But
you would have had to go back home.
Yes. Because like that was my only chance, and I got, fortunately, I got selected in the lottery and was able to get through H-1B.
Yeah, that's got to be a nerve-wracking process, the lottery, right? Again, I mentioned earlier just the luck piece of this. A lottery to figure out your future, your career?
I mean, I did have a couple of friends who did not get selected three times in a row in the lottery, and they had to go back. So it is purely like a randomness associated with it. Like at one point, you cannot like really lose your mind over it because you don't control that. Being
easier
an engineer,
said than done, Prashant. Easier said than done. Christina, how many people are people like Prashant competing with in this lottery, just so we have a sense?
Well, it sort of varies by year. Last year, the numbers were about 350,000. So you had about a 1 in 3 chance.
Wow.
Because there are always folks who are selected and then either aren't eligible, or the employer maybe changes their mind, or maybe they change their mind. But we've seen it even higher. A couple of years ago, there were 780,000 registrations.
Wow.
For 85,000 spots.
But he just said he got it on the first try. I mean, is your mind not blown,
I mean,
Christina?
We get some people, and then I have the poor individuals who... Literally, it's their fourth try, and then they finally get it. Mm. They don't wait. They give no, if just because you were in it last year, you don't get any kind of waiting or advantage. The employer is just starting at square one. And that's, I think, part of the issue is, like, if you didn't have to go through this process, why would you ever hire a non-American worker? So these employers really need these people. They're going to great financial expense.
Absolutely.
You know, and also just the effort. You know, I work with a lot of HR individuals, and they're like, oh my gosh, this is so complicated. Yeah. And, you know, it's fine once you get going on it, but if they could just hire a U.S. worker, which does include green card holders, there's a lot of regulations. So these are people who need sponsorship, like you were saying.
It's definitely part needing these employees, right? Needing their special skills. And it's also, you know, as someone on the, not on the technical, but more on the creative side of things, and having gone through a good portion of this process myself, there's also just like believing in your talents, right? The employer just like saying, okay, this person is really like top of their field in that country. How can we get them here to do that work? Right?
Sure. And there are, you know, you mentioned creatives, you know, it is available. And there are special visas for individuals from different countries. Mm-hmm. Canada enjoys at the moment a wonderful visa program, but it's very narrow.
Right? You mean the TN?
Yes.
Yeah, you have the TN. So this is part of the US, Mexico, and Canada trade agreement, if you will. And the TN visa has very specific list of jobs where you can get this visa. It's actually easy in the sense that you can actually just go to the border, if I understand this correctly, and you can sort of apply for it, you know, bringing all your paperwork, but apply for it on the spot. Whereas you can't do that with what we're talking about with Prashant. And that's something totally different.
Correct. And only Canadians can do that. Mexicans still have to go to the U.S. Embassy and actually get a visa, and then they can they present at the border for entry. The thing about the TN is it's a very narrow, mm-hmm. If you're a chemist, you must have a degree in chemistry.
Like accountant.
Exactly.
Technical writer, like very specific
and
list.
Radio broadcaster.
Radio broadcaster wasn't on the list. Believe me, I tried. So tell me more about how you talk to friends and family right now, Prashant, about your visa status. What are the conversations like?
I mean, the conversation is more personal because, I recently got married here in U.S. in Courthouse.
Oh, congratulations.
So, thank you. So we were supposed to have like a wedding reception back in India end of like this year. Mm-hmm. But because of H-1B visa appointment and lack of uncertainty, and we have to cancel that. We're not doing it.
Wait, so you canceled your big wedding
right.
that was scheduled to happen in India?
Yes.
Because you simply can't go there.
If I go there, I do need to get a visa stamp to come back. But as long as I'm inside the country, my approval notice is good enough. But if I leave the country to come back, I need a visa stamp. And to get a visa stamp, you need to get an appointment, which recently changed yesterday that, you know, you do need to have an in-person appointment. Earlier, it was like Dropbox.
How long does it take to get those appointments?
I'm looking for December. I haven't found one yet.
And, oh, my goodness.
So the thing is, you have to keep looking like every like four times a day. And after
in July,
you're
trying to get December.
Yes. And sometimes it can even take like more than a year, like, you know, to get an appointment.
Wow. Speaking of the way people are talking about this, let's hear a little something.
You see some big tech companies where they'll lay off 9,000 workers and then they'll apply for a bunch of overseas visas. And I sort of wonder, that doesn't totally make sense to me.
The math doesn't.
That displacement and that math worries me a bit. And what the president has said, he said very clearly, we want the very best and the brightest to make America their home. We want them to build great companies and so forth. But I don't want companies to fire 9,000 American workers and then to go and say, we can't find workers here in America. Yeah.
So that was Vice President J.D. Vance. Big claims there from the Vice President, Christina. Any accuracy there, in your view?
I mean, I think he, to sort of make a blanket statement that he fired 9,000 workers, there are going to be sectors where layoffs are happening across, you know, we saw that recently. But nobody in those companies was then turning. First of all, you can't just turn around and hire H-1B lawyers mm-hmm. or employees. Sorry. You always have to wait for the lottery.
Right.
You always have to, you're always operating in those constraints. So it would be very unlikely that you could just turn around and replace those workers. And also it doesn't account for the fact that there's different occupations that they're talking about. You know, are they letting go of a particular department?
Right.
So, you know, the problem is when you're at this level and in a lot of these news shows, they're making these blanket sort of claims about how the categories work, and they're just so much more complex.
I think it's adding to some of the misconception that a lot of people have on how these things work. And that's why I'm so grateful that you're here with us, so that folks can hear Prashant, a personal story, right? And hear how it really happens. What was it like for you to hear J.D. Vance saying those things?
It sounds very oversimplified. Even among H-1B, Christina mentioned before, you have two categories. Like, there are people who did masters and PhDs. So I think it's also not easy to hire an H-1B. I think an employer would rather hire someone, they would take the path of least resistance, mm-hmm. then go through this immigration. There's no uncertainty. Like, you could be stuck, in your home country if you go for a vacation. So
right.
I don't know why would anyone intentionally think this is going to benefit me. I don't see someone in their sane mind, why would they go down this path of hiring, like, you know, like H-1B workers, it's not easy. It's going to cost you money. It's going to cost a lot of, like, you know, maneuvers.
Yeah.
So it sounds very oversimplified and definitely political.
He's glossing over the need.
Yeah.
The clear need. So tell me about the changes. Speaking of the administration, what do they want now? What are the changes they're trying to propose here when it comes to work visas?
Sure. Well, one of the things we saw during his last administration was this idea that they would wait H-1B registrations according to the salary they were going to be paid, the offered wage. And the Department of Labor classifies job difficulty by levels. There's four levels, and the higher you go up, the more the wage is going to be. So somebody who's, you know, a job that requires a master's degree and 5 years of experience mm-hmm. might be, you know, at a level three or a level four, which could be $200,000 versus an $80,000 employee at level one. So they said, okay, well, we're just going to rank the jobs, the applicants in order of salary, and we'll just give the $85,000 highest than H-1B.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is, well, not only it seems to me to go around congressional intent in establishing the visa, but it also means that startups, incubators, a lot of the companies where some of our best innovations and growth are coming from in this country are not going to be able to afford to use H-1B workers. And the other thing to remember is the H-1B workforce, it's a very tiny number.
Yeah.
85,000 workers, I read a statistic that it's 0.05% of the
right.
workforce. It's a tiny little sliver.
It's so over, you know, blown that you would think it was everybody, right?
Exactly.
Running out of time here, but Prashant, you know, again, congratulations on the recent wedding ceremony that you had here in Chicago. Your wife, I hear, is on a green card. What's next for you? And the backup in case you lose your visa?
So, I mean, I filed for a green card through wedding, but again, that is another story. That even my wife went through like 6 years. She has to be outside of the country to mm-hmm. get it. So it'll take another 2 to 3 years. But until then, like, you know, I'll have to be, thankfully, I have my H-1B, you know, extended because I have my I-140 approved, which is my employer green card.
Right.
So, like, I'll be on H-1B for next 2 years until my green card through my wedding gets approved.
Well, we are hoping for the very best for you, Prashant. Again, thank you for sharing your story. Christina Coleman, founding partner of Coleman Immigration. We appreciate your knowledge and your time.
Thank you so much for having us today.
Thank you so much.
This episode of The Reset Podcast was produced by Aryan Kumar. It was edited by Daniel Tucker and mixed by Micah Yasin. Here on Reset, we have conversations about the nation's and Chicago's most pressing issues. This series highlights the stories of real people going through the process of working and living in the United States. This is just one example of how we bring the voices of often overlooked people to you. So to stay connected to every episode, hit subscribe where you listen or find us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening, and we'll meet again later today.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.